make is believing that there is only one way to live.
That's
and
right.
That we don't accept that there are diverse ways of being in the world, that there are millions of ways to be a
then
human
how do
being.
We please
and,
God?
And many ways, no, but many paths to what you call God.
That
and
is
her path
crazy.
Might be something else, and when she gets there, she might call it the light. But her loving and her kindness and her generosity brings her, if it brings her to the same point that it brings you, it doesn't matter whether she called it God along the way or not.
I
there couldn't possibly be just one way. What about Jesus? What about Jesus?
That's Oprah Winfrey. Oprah is there talking about one of the biggest mistakes people make is assuming that there is only one way to God. We're going to be talking about a related question to that. Are all religions the same? As our guest here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. says, the sameness doctrine, this idea that, well, there is truth. There certainly is truth. And while not all religions are necessarily true, they all basically boil down to the same thing. We're going to be answering that particular bit of wisdom that's floating around nowadays here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Wynn Cordwin is going to be our guest here to answer that question at the beginning of the program. He is a professor of philosophy and religion at Taylor University. Then we'll follow with a 25-minute conversation with Pastor Clement Preuss, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, Lutheran Theology in Practice. We're going to talk with him about the dynamism of American Christianity. He said the excitement of American Christianity represents the staff of Christian practice being bent. He goes on to say that the dynamism of American Christianity represents the staff of Christian practice being broken. We'll find out what he means by that in the second half hour of Issues, Etc. Now, in the second hour of the program, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. One of the things we're going to be hearing, some stories that have been in the news, we hope in that second hour, possibly to hear from Congressman Todd Akin. He, of course, has one side of a debate in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on stem cell research. He is arguing for, I believe, the legislation, or against the legislation 810, the House Resolution 810, that would broaden the number of stem cell lines from in vitro fertilization embryos. We'll find out why he is objecting there in the second hour if he's able to join us. We'll also have open lines. Three questions I've got for you. Picking up on our Joyce Meyer interview yesterday, you might have read in the paper today that she was invited to be a speaker at one of two baccalaureate services being held for Lindbergh High School. Her appearance, I believe, was last night. What do you think about baccalaureates? Should schools have baccalaureate services? They are religious services that usually coincide with graduation. And if Joyce was invited to your high school baccalaureate, would that make a difference on whether you went or not? We'll also be talking about the Bible being read in a school in Philadelphia and some audio on the filibuster compromise that the Senate came to earlier today. Then in the third hour of the program, we're going to replay that Joyce Meyer interview and get your reaction, your thoughts, your comments, and your questions during open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Wynn Cordwin is a professor of philosophy and religion at Taylor University. He is author of the book, A Tapestry of Faith, Common Threads Among World Religions. He's also written an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled, Are All Religions the Same at Their Core? Wynn, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. It sure is good to be back with you.
Well, you make a distinction early in your article between two different, same-sounding but different ideas about kind of the unity of all religions. One of them presupposes that there is absolute truth. The other one presupposes that there isn't. Distinguish between those two for us.
Right. Yeah, in the terms of contemporary relativism, you can just say truth doesn't really matter, and there really is no such thing as truth. The sameness doctrine that a lot of people hold to, and they're not necessarily really distinguishing between the two in their minds, but what they're really saying is that there is one fundamental truth, and it does matter. And when you look at what all religions teach at their very core, then they all wind up manifesting exactly the same thing, more or less.
Okay, so does this basically, what we're going to be talking about during this 25 minutes, basically come down to someone who says, as we heard in the open of our program, Oprah Winfrey says, look, you got many paths, but all of them lead to the same God, and all of them essentially boil down to the same core values, and that's what it's really all about.
Yeah, and I really don't know how Oprah could know such a thing. Somehow she must be omniscient and must have studied all religions in the universe and must have uncovered something that has totally eluded me, namely this notion that somehow they all teach the same thing, because frankly, the more that I study other religions, the more I realize how different they are.
It has been my observation more often than not, as you have just observed about Oprah Winfrey, that people who make statements like, well, all religions, if you closely examine them, you find a broader agreement there, and if you get past the particulars, you'll find that they're all really the same. People who make statements like that have not closely examined very many religions.
That's about the only way that you can do it. It's like if you have poor eyesight or you put on glasses that are deliberately distorting your vision, and you look at two houses and make sure that you're standing far enough away, and you can say, oh, look it, they look the same. But as soon as you actually look closely at what they teach, then, or at the two houses, then they're actually very different. And the same thing is true with religions. You know, I'm teaching my students at Taylor University, and we're, you know, doing very rigorous study, and they have to read the scriptures of the religions themselves. And there isn't a single one of my students who would even imagine walking away from my class thinking they teach the same thing.
You quote in your Christian Research Journal article John Hick, and I will quote in part. I want you to explain to me what he means when he says, there is a spiritual reality that goes beyond common human experience. Human beings are finite and often do not live up to their full potential, and they may even do evil things. All religions serve to help humans make contact with this spiritual reality and thereby lead better lives. That term came up twice. What in the world does John Hick mean by spiritual reality?
Well, that's a good question. And by the way, that's not a quote. Unfortunately, the editors put it in such a way that it looks like a quote, but it was just supposed to be a summary, and it's not really a verbatim statement. But the phrase reality with a capital R is something that Hick uses all the time. Now, the most distinguishing feature about spiritual reality, capital R, the way that John Hick uses it, is that it is beyond our categories of comprehension. In other words, in order to really be talking about whatever it is that Hick refers to as reality, first of all, you have to concede that you can't really talk about. Well, you know, in that case, it's pretty easy to say that everybody relates themselves to reality because, by definition, it's the kind of thing that nobody can relate to. So what he means by that is something that is really, really cool, something that is unbelievably wonderful and supreme and absolute, and somehow, even though you can't capture it in words, it's the kind of thing that we talk about when we think we're talking about God.
So all language, all God talk, be it Buddhist God talk, Christian God talk, Muslim God talk, all theology is mere words. We are simply bandying about best guesses or approximations or provisional statements about something that none of us can really possibly know about?
That's right, and that's why John Hick and others who take that position, including that statement by Oprah you played earlier, are really examples of the worst kind of intolerance. Because, you know, what John Hick is saying is that what I think I believe, I really don't believe, and I can't believe. And same thing with Oprah, because even though, you know, she makes it sound as though she is just so tolerant and acceptant. But really what she's saying, first of all, to me is that when I believe that God is absolute, I am wrong. And anyone else, whether they be Buddhists or Muslims or Hindus or whatever, what they believe is wrong. What all of us really believe is this unfathomable, inexpressible reality.
Isn't it kind of a form of what was called politically about a decade ago triangulation? That is, someone, say Oprah Winfrey or John Hick, claims to have a purely objective view of everything. No one else is objective. Everyone else is mired in their own misconceptions about God, but they can rise above it and see all of the arguing for what it is, mere quibbling over words. I then see true reality as it is, and I can tell everyone, hey, what you're arguing about is all really immaterial. It's all surface differences. We're all really the same underneath.
That's exactly what it is. The person who's saying these things has to have pretty much ascended a throne of omniscience beyond that of any mere mortals.
Now, you say this sameness doctrine, as you call it, otherwise probably more commonly known as pluralism, religious pluralism,
mm-hmm.
presents a double challenge to Orthodox Christians. What are those challenges?
Well, the two challenges that I'm talking about in that article is, for one thing, I need to be clear how and why this is wrong, but then the other challenge is to be able to present it in a conversation in such a way that I'm not just turning off the person that I'm speaking with because they have been raised now in an environment where all religions are the same has become something of a mantra. And so, you know, the kind of things that you and I have been saying a minute ago are certainly not conversation openers. They're conversation closers. And so the second challenge is to try to present this in such a way that people are still going to listen to you and aren't just going to write you off as politically incorrect.
We're answering the very common question nowadays, are all religions the same? Dr. Wynn Corduin is our guest. He's professor of philosophy and religion at Taylor University. This is Issues Etc., and I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 15 minutes on the program, we will talk to Pastor Clement Preuss about the dynamism of American Christianity. So maybe the first thing to understand when you're dealing with someone who says, well, all paths lead to God and all religions boil down to the same thing, is to realize that this person probably has not thought that statement through very carefully.
That's right. And so, you know, first thought should be, he really means to say something that's not as universal as it sounds. And he obviously hasn't studied all religions in the universe. And chances are when you're talking to a person, they're not just strutting their tolerance out, but they're saying something that they at least feel very sincere about. So first thing to realize would be, okay, he probably means to say most religions, many religions, most of the world religions, and as I say in the article, cut the person some slack. Don't just pounce and say, ha, you just made a universal statement that you can't support. But let's work through this a little bit. And first of all, recognize that chances are no human being has studied all religions. So from the expert to the layperson, chances are we're all speaking without necessarily knowing what every religion in the universe teaches.
When you have written this book, and we've talked to you about the book, Tapestry of Faith, Common Threads Among the World Religion, and there are commonalities among world religions. It's hardly remarkable since most, with the exception of Christianity, most world religions are the invention of the human imagination. So they would tend to be the same, I would think. But how far does that commonality go, really?
Not as far as one might like to think. Even on the most obvious levels. For one thing, words oftentimes do have different meanings for different religions. So even if you want to say something as general as most religions believe in God and prayer and worship and salvation, when you look at what those religions actually mean by those terms, the commonality goes away pretty quickly. And this would also apply to, say, the ethical teachings of those religions, even though most religions teach some very basic ideas like don't steal, don't lie, don't commit adultery. Even there, what they mean by those statements oftentimes winds up taking very specific forms in the context of their religions.
Let's get to some suggestions, simple suggestions that you make when dealing with the person you meet at work or in your family who has bought into what you have called this mantra that all religions are essentially the same. Where would you begin by way of practical suggestions for the Orthodox Christian in this situation?
Yeah, I think, now in the article I'm saying that we got to realize that the fact that Christianity is uniquely true is a different issue from whether all religions teach the same thing. However, if you talk about this in terms of my personal experience, my personal knowledge, chances are Christianity is the religion that I know best. So I think it's going to be most helpful if the Orthodox Christian starts to share a little bit about what Christianity teaches, not necessarily to confront the person and to say, ha, you're wrong when it comes to Christianity, but just to demonstrate that there is a difference and that Christianity does not seem to fit into the mushy kind of pattern that people oftentimes set up.
You say that we should try to learn as much as we possibly can about other religions.
Absolutely. And I think that's becoming more and more of a necessity. And I would say that more strongly now than I did 10 years ago. I still want to say, look, Christians don't have to know all there is to know about Hinduism or Islam. And I don't think we need to lay unnecessary burdens on ourselves. But as we're watching our culture become more and more pluralistic and to see more and more religions integrating into American culture, there is simply no excuse if we just totally pass off what they believe as simply false and superstition. If I say that I love my neighbor, then I have got to take an interest in what they believe. And furthermore, I think, I hate to say this publicly like this, but I will. I think a lot of Christians embarrass themselves by making pronouncements concerning other religions which just plain aren't true, and we get upset when non-Christians misrepresent Christianity, and I think we need to be very careful that we don't misrepresent whatever religion we're talking about.
So, in other words, the truth is never furthered by stretching it. Overstating the case about another religion does not further one's argument that the Christianity is distinct from other religions and that other religions are distinct from one another.
That's right. We need to make sure that we let the truth speak for itself. And I guess, you know, in many ways, that's what this conversation is all about. If we, you know, don't superimpose other schemes on other religions, either from the vantage point of the sameness doctrine and just try to make them all the same, or from the vantage point of Christianity and make them all look worse than they are. I think the truth can speak for itself, and God's truth will come out crystal clear by contrast.
Finally here, when you write that ultimately this sameness doctrine, this desire for all religions to be the same at their heart, is just that, an effort in wishful thinking that does not do justice to each religion itself.
Right. Ultimately, it comes out of either sincere or misguided or maybe very intentional efforts to try to trivialize the truth of specific religions. And, you know, for example, for John Hick, it was a very intentional effort to try to minimize the truth of Christianity. He had committed himself to Christianity, and I suppose once he realized that he no longer believed what he had claimed to believe at one time, he could have just said it's all false. But instead he said, oh, it really doesn't matter because it's just an expression of this ultimate reality, capital R. And so I think there is this this intention behind it that all other religions or all religions become trivialized by simply absorbing them into this super mush scheme.
Dr. Wynn Corcoran, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks. I always enjoy it very much. Bye-bye.
Wynn is professor of philosophy and religion at Taylor University. He is author of the book, A Tapestry of Faiths, Common Threads Among the World Religions. And he's written this article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled, Are All Religions the Same at Their Core? It is a subject, by the way, that will be probably brought up in a very intense way at a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar in Trago, Wisconsin this summer. I'm thinking in particular by two regular guests on this program who'll be speaking there at this Worldview seminar. One, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, who'll be talking about the new polytheism. And also, in a more specific way, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, as he talks about Islam at a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar in Trago, Wisconsin this summer. Now, call the Schwann Center during this break for a free brochure, 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848. Ask for that free brochure all about a Confessional Christian Worldview seminar this summer at the Schwann Center, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. You will find the Schwann Center logo right there on the homepage. Click on that, you'll get all the information you need, or call 1-800-577-4848. When we come back from this break, Pastor Clement Preuss, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, Lutheran Theology and Practice, is going to be our guest. We talked last time with him about the excitement of American Christianity, how excitement, emotional excitement, has replaced faith. When we come back, the dynamism of American Christianity. Stay tuned.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you looking for a vacation this summer where you can relax, renew, and refocus? Well, I have just the opportunity for you. It's a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 26th through July the 2nd, at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. It's about 2 hours from Minneapolis. Not only will you have the chance to relax in the beauty and serenity of the picturesque Namekagon River, two private lakes, miles of hiking trails, and abundant wildlife, but you'll also have the opportunity to refocus and renew by listening to instruction from Issues, Etc. regular guests Gene Edward Veith, Alvin Schmidt, and Angus Manouge. Now, for more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848. Ask for information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 26th through July the 2nd, in northern Wisconsin. 1-800-577-4848.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. For years, you have had to buy hot dogs in 8-packs, even though the buns came 6 or 12 to a package. You're always complaining about having extra buns, said Angelica Jacobs. Do you make sandwiches? Do you throw them out? When I say I'm in the hot dog business, the first thing people say is, how come buns and dogs come in different amounts? Said Howard Ehrenberg, president of Vienna Beef. But now, the dog and bun controversy is coming to an end. Vienna Beef and Alpha Baking Company have agreed to make 8 packs of both. We think it's the perfect opportunity to right a 100-year wrong, said Ehrenberg. Most of us are spectators in the big debates of life. None of us has influence in the Senate debate over filibusters. When the company you work for debates policies like downsizing or employee benefits, do they consult you? It's like getting stuck with extra buns, and you can't do a thing about it. Things are different, though, in your more personal relationships. With your family, with your co-workers, with your neighbors, you can move to end long-standing disagreements. Romans 12, verse 18 says, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everybody. Hot dogs and buns wait 100 years to make peace, but not the followers of the Prince of Peace.
Giving the gospel of Christ to people while helping to develop entire communities is the focus of this Global Minute. Pray for Christians in Kenya and Uganda. Simply showing local people how to hang mosquito nets to prevent malaria is a basic way of strengthening the health of others. Then assisting people in digging fresh water wells to benefit an entire village is another part of community development. The agency Mission Moving Mountains combines building up communities with biblical discipleship. Thousands of Christians in Uganda and Kenya are involved in anticipating future blessings for their families. Pray for missionaries and Christian leaders with Mission Moving Mountains to see the prayers for their people answered as Christ is glorified among them. Get inspired to pray around the world. Visit the website missionvisionnetwork.org. It's a missions resource for you and your church. missionvisionnetwork.org.
The Jefferson National Expansion Memorial, the Jefferson National Parks Association, and the Gateway Arch Riverfront are hosting an art contest for children ages 5 through 18. Artists are invited to submit their works that depict their experience with the Gateway Arch or their interpretation of its themes as a memorial. Entry for eligible artists is free, and submissions will be judged according to 3 age categories. Visit nps.gov/Jeff for more information.
Headed into the second hour here on Issues Etc., Pastor Clement Preuss is our guest. He is author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for May called The Fire and the Staff. Now, the title of that book figures prominently into one of the things that I'm very curious about in this 25 minutes. He writes about, last time we talked with him, the excitement of American Christianity, how emotional excitement has in many ways replaced doctrine, even faith. In the minds of many Christians, maybe even unwittingly replaced it in their experience. What about the dynamism of American Christianity? What does Clem mean by dynamism? We'll find out here in just a few minutes. In about 25 minutes, we have open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be talking about baccalaureate services. Is this a good idea? It's a religious service that's usually associated with graduation. Should schools have baccalaureate services? What are your concerns about these services? What do you remember from any baccalaureate service you might have attended when you graduated from high school or college? And Joyce Meyer was invited to at least one of 2 baccalaureate services for Lindbergh High School here in St. Louis. If you found out Joyce was the speaker at a baccalaureate service, what difference would that make to you? Speaking of Joyce Meyer, in the third hour of the program, where we play our interview that we had with her yesterday and get your reaction, more open lines in the third hour of the program. Pastor Clement Preuss is our guest. He's pastor of Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota, president of the Lutheran Youth Organization Higher Things, and as I mentioned, he's authored our Issues, Etc., book of the month for May, The Fire and the Staff. Clem, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, Pastor Preuss, this is, you say that the fire is doctrine and the staff is practice in a very broad way.
Right.
Last time we talked, you said that the excitement of American Christianity represents this staff of practice, Christian practice, being bent. Today we're going to talk about the dynamism of American Christianity. You say that that represents the staff of Christian practice being broken. What do you mean by that?
Well, when the staff is practice and when the practices change so radically that you don't even recognize them anymore as being traditional Christian practices, then the staff no longer is able to guide us to the fire, if you will. The practices don't correspond to our doctrine and our faith, our the gospel, and mislead us in that way. So I think the church is often has practices which are so contrary to the gospel itself that the gospel is undermined by our very practices.
What do you mean by dynamism in the church?
Well, the word dynamism or dynamite or dynamic is the same as the word power. And in the church, the power of God unto salvation is the gospel. God is the power through his holy word to bring people to Jesus Christ, to forgive their sins, to sustain their faith unto eternal life. That's the power. However, often you hear people talking about dynamic pastors, as if the pastor is the one who saves, not the gospel. Or dynamic congregations, as if there's something about a group of people which has more blessed by the Spirit than another group of people. And I think that is often a very unfortunate way of us thinking, that dynamism is not in the people, but it's in God.
So you quote C. Peter Wagner, who has been for years a leading light in the church growth movement and therefore in much of American Protestantism. He has of late gone quite a bit divergent from his previous views, even now talking about signs and wonders and New World apostles and things like that. But you quote him saying, and it sounds so innocuous, one characteristic of healthy churches is that they grow. Well, what's wrong with that statement?
Well, that is not necessarily a characteristic of a healthy church. I mean, obviously, we want our congregations to grow if it's a legitimate growth caused by the gospel. But if the church grows because the gospel is compromised or because we attract people who through something besides the gospel, then that's not necessarily a sign of any kind of growth. In the history of Christianity, growth in the church has not necessarily always been a sign of its effectiveness, or I mean of the gospel's presence. I mean, the Mormon church is one of the fastest growing churches in the world, and I don't think any Christian would say that the Mormon church has the gospel. So growth is not a barometer necessarily.
So it really wouldn't be any surprise to discover that say Fuller Theological Seminary, which was the home of C. Peter Wagner for some time, and then, of course, the home of the modern church growth movement, has been looking very longingly at Mormonism, asking the question, well, what are they doing right? Why are they growing? Maybe we should imitate them.
I wouldn't be. That's shocking, but not surprising. I mean, we could look at the Muslims, for that matter. They grow in certain areas. Do we really want to grow at and learn from such people how to grow a church when Jesus has already told us that you make disciples in a specific way, by teaching them or by baptizing and by teaching? I mean, it's a fairly easy concept.
When we hear advocates of dynamism in the church talk about dynamic churches, what are they usually describing? Give us a thumbnail sketch.
Well, I think they're describing churches which have certain programs. They're describing churches which are all turned on. Usually the worship is altered from what it traditionally has been. And I think they're describing churches which appeal to our culture. And so the people from the culture go there and feel comfortable immediately. Whereas the Christian church may not be that appealing to a specific culture, especially a culture such as ours, which is very, very secular and very postmodern. Our culture is not going to be attracted to Orthodox Christianity. So there's a danger of changing the church and changing the gospel to make it appealing to our culture and then designating it as a dynamic congregation.
Well, does it go along in line? Is it really any different to talk about the dynamism in the church as a real threat to the church's integrity, especially its doctrinal integrity? Is it any different to talk about all the other modifiers that are stuck on the church nowadays? We've got purpose-driven churches. We've got mission-minded churches. We have courageous churches. We have contagious churches. We have effective churches. We have all sorts of modifiers that we stick in front of the church.
Yeah, and you know, it all ends up being the same. That's a good laundry list you just listed there. that mission-minded, courageous, effective, purpose-driven, whatever you want to call it, whenever you put such adjectives in front of the church, it gives the impression that the church is something more than that which receives Jesus Christ and speaks his word to the world. And that's all the church really is. How can a church be more effective than another church if both churches are carrying out the ministry of the gospel? They would be equally effective, it would seem to me. And I think that the church growth movement and the whole idea of having dynamic congregations is somewhat Pentecostal in nature in that it postulates a two-tiered understanding of the church, just as Pentecostalism postulated a two-tiered expression of Christianity, carnal Christians and spirit-filled Christians. So the church growth movement has a tendency to talk about carnal congregations and spirit-filled congregations. They don't use those terms, but that's what they talk about. Regular old dying churches and then power-driven churches, purpose-driven churches, mission-minded churches, whatever the word may be.
We talked earlier about, and this goes nicely with what we're discussing now, the divorce of word from spirit. And you said one of the inevitable results when a church or a Christian divorces God's external word of the gospel, the message of Jesus Christ crucified for sinners, from the Holy Spirit, as though the two, you say a spiritless word or a wordless spirit, if they believe such a thing could exist, the inevitable result, among other things, is this two-tiered Christianity. This sounds like then you're just saying this is kind of written large to the congregational level.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What happens is that historically, the way Lutherans at least looked at it, is you knew that God was powerful when the word was spoken, when the sacraments were administered. It was the source of the power, regardless of what effect you saw. You had faith in the power of the word, regardless of what you saw. It wasn't an empirical thing where you could measure it. It was a faith in the gospel. But now it becomes an empirical thing where we have to see the effect of the gospel to believe it's powerful. And churches need to convince themselves that they are a powerful church. And the only way they can do that is to grow. It becomes a desperate need, almost a self-authenticating need on the part of congregations. And so they will do anything to grow very often, and that means even compromising the gospel. That's the dynamic that's at work among us, if you pardon that, the expression of that word. So there's a church I drive by every day on the way to my church, and it'll say, 10 new members, ain't God great? And they make it seem as though the love of God and the greatness of God and even the grace of God can be known only if the church grows. And that's a terribly dangerous thing because the church sometimes does not grow in that way.
Another little credo I've heard in churches that have bought into this new dynamism and replaced human dynamism, human power, with the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes the gospel message is whatever it takes. You hear it so often and so cavalierly. Whatever it takes to get new disciples, whatever it takes to make the church grow, that's what we'll do. I have observed, and I don't know if you agree, that is not a strategy. That is the admission that you have no strategy and that you're willing to, well, sell your soul.
Well, right, because, you know, I hadn't thought of that, but that's exactly right. Whatever it takes is an admission that you don't know what to do. Because we do know what to do as Christians. We know what the Great Commission is. We baptize, we teach, we administer the sacrament of the altar. That's a strategy or that's a game plan, and that's what we do. Now, we may not do it as zealously as we should always, and we may not do it with as much energy as we should. We may take more time off than we can justify. But the way people are brought to heaven and brought into the church legitimately is through the word and the sacrament. To say whatever it takes suggests that there's something we do more than the word and the sacrament. Worse yet, it suggests that the word and the sacrament is simply not enough. And that's a very dangerous thing. It takes Christ out of Christianity.
Is it also what Luther would have termed a theology of glory as opposed to the theology of the cross? Explain those two terms for us, if you would.
Well, theology of the cross says that we need to look to the suffering of Jesus Christ and possibly our own suffering. One of the things Luther said is that it is certain that a man must utterly despair of his own ability before he is prepared to receive the grace of Christ. That's part of being a Christian, to utterly despair of our own ability. Well, I don't see that in the church growth movement. utterly despairing of my ability is contrary to do whatever it takes. And I think that's what happens. The theology of the cross forces us to go back to the gospel, the sacraments, these lowly means of grace that don't seem that good, but we're forced to trust them because that's where God points us.
We're talking with Pastor Clement Preuss about the dynamism of American Christianity. He is pastor of Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota, president of the Lutheran Youth Organization Higher Things, and author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May, The Fire and the Staff, Lutheran Theology and Practice. One of the first things you mentioned in this conversation, Pastor Preuss, is that term dynamic pastor or exciting pastor, spirit-filled pastor. They all mean the same thing, as you said before. What should the church really expect of its pastors, other than what the churches, the church growth advocates are telling us? You know, good looking, nice hair, nice teeth, maybe a goatee if he's hip, nice dresser, likable guy, and able to really talk at the people's level, good conversational teaching, things like that. What should the church expect?
The church should expect from her pastors men who are competent to understand and explain the scriptures, and men who are faithful to the evangelical doctrine and who are faithful in preaching the gospel and administering the sacraments. That's all the church has the right to expect. I suppose we could add to that that they adorn that gospel with a moral life and don't bring shame upon the cause of Christ by outward immorality. But other than that, that's I think the scriptures don't give us a whole lot more on what pastors should be. That it's word-orientated much more than people-orientated. There was a phenomenon in our country called folk religion. It's still quite popular, and that's the idea that pastors have to be folksy. They have to be people persons. They have to know people and really understand people. And while that may be very helpful, that is not an essential characteristic of a pastor. Faithfulness to the word is. Unfortunately, in our day and age, if a pastor isn't a very good people person, if he gets on the wrong side of some people in his congregation, his job may be jeopardized, even though he would be a faithful pastor. And that is a very unfortunate development. But you can see it springs right out of the notion that pastors should be dynamic in their style rather than trust the power of the gospel for their dynamism.
We did open lines a couple of years ago on this program, and we asked a very simple question and got some surprising answers. The question was, does your pastor have to be at least marginally good-looking for your church to grow? And the backside of the question was, can an ugly pastor, pot-bellied and bald-headed with bad teeth, be a church growth pastor? Now, I was surprised at the answers. A fair number of our listeners said, yes, pastors need to be good-looking. One lady even called and said, our pastors, all of them are good-looking. I said, how good-looking? She said, Brad Pitt good-looking. And she said, that's why our church is growing. An example of this kind of dynamism in the church that's replaced the gospel?
Oh, that's sad commentary. And I think it's a direct result of the Madison Avenue marketing approach that we've often taken to Christianity. Now, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings here, but I don't think that C.F.W. Walther was a particularly good-looking man. In fact, I think he was just plain out not very attractive. And yet, he was one of the founding fathers of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and probably one of the most famous Lutherans of the 19th century. By that standard, he would not have qualified for the ministry today. And I'm quite sure that Jesus Christ himself may not have been particularly good-looking. I'll tell you this, when he was on the cross, he had no form of comeliness that we should admire him, says the prophet Isaiah. So Jesus was not a real good-looking guy while he was dying for the sins of the world. I don't think God needs good-looking. I think God doesn't need anything, but we need a Savior who is bloody and gory and willing to sacrifice his looks for the sins of the world.
We're told, this seems a small matter, but you've written at least a short section in this chapter of The Fire and the Staff on the pastor's dress. I mean, it used to be rather standard, depending on what your church was, a modest dress, but the pastor's dress was, at least in our tradition, a clerical collar, more often than not. It was his uniform. Nowadays, that uniform is being laid aside because it's considered a barrier. Or worse yet, it's considered irrelevant. What case are you trying to make about the pastor's uniform?
Well, in my own experience, in my own career as a pastor, I've been a pastor for 29 years, I didn't used to wear a collar because I figured I'm the pastor. They know who I am. But in the past few years, I've worn a collar more and more and more because I'm not altogether convinced people do know who I am. Even my own members sometimes, they need a reminder that this is a pastor, that I've been called by God to speak God's word to them. It's a reminder of what my job is, both to me and to them. My job is to speak the word of God to my people. And if a collar helps remind us of that relationship, then it should be worn. And especially in a day and age where people tend to forget what a pastor's job is. It's not to be a hail fellow, well-met, back-slapping guy who you can go to a bar and have a drink with and relate to real well. But he's God's spokesman. And the reminder of a collar often helps, at least in our tradition, for people to remember that.
What about when that collar is not on a man, you've spoken in masculine terms consistently here, but on a woman?
Well, the whole question of women pastors, of course, is very controversial. But I think one of the things we need to consider is this. Would a dynamic woman, a woman very gifted and talented, a great speaker, be a good pastor by his church growth standards? She may even be good-looking. Would that be a good pastor? Well, I think most people would say, well, by our perspective, sure. But in the Bible, there still are these passages, and they're quite clear, which preclude women from speaking, preaching, teaching in the church. And though we may not like it, and I know that there are probably very many women who don't like those Bible passages and want to read them out of the Scriptures, they're still there. What God is forcing us to do is to trust him, even contrary to our common sense, is to believe that in spite of the fact that many women are incredibly gifted and dynamic, God still chooses, as his pastors, men, and by that I mean males only. And for reasons that are obvious from the Scriptures, that's what he has done.
You write about blurring distinctions, and that kind of a way of describing some of the problems or diagnosing some of the problems in the church, it applies to so many things. What are the few places where you see necessary scriptural distinctions being blurred? You just mentioned one, of course, blurring of the distinctions between the sexes.
Obviously, and that's a key one today. You see that all over our culture, where we can't even decide who ought to get married. It should be a man with a woman and a woman with a man. But, I mean, even churches are debating the whole question of homosexual marriage. If that's not a blurring of distinction, I don't know what is. You see the same in women pastors. In other areas where distinctions are blurred, the most obvious one to me is the distinctions between church bodies and between confessions of faith, where people slip from a Methodist church to a Presbyterian church to a Baptist church and to a Lutheran church with relative ease, as if the distinctions and the differences of a doctrinal nature between these churches are almost irrelevant. And you hear the church growth pundits saying that there's denominational disloyalty, that no one has any loyalty to the denominations anymore, as if that's okay. Well, it is not okay. The differences between the churches are extremely important, and if God wants us to be a pure church, he would want us to seek out that church which is faithful to the Scripture. Other places where I think distinctions are blurred are probably in the area of good-looking pastors and ugly pastors. I mean, there's a case where people are making a distinction without a difference, where there is no difference whatsoever. What kind of liturgy you use, that's another distinction which is very important. And yet I've talked to people who said, oh, it doesn't matter, well, style is completely unimportant, whatever you like. That's just to name three or four.
Now, I'm wondering if this principle of dynamism in the church has become in actual kind of on-the-ground, Sunday-by-Sunday cases, a filter. That is, I walk into a church, this is just, you know, a little anecdotal experience. I walk into a church where the music is oppressively loud, where the people are almost rigidly happy. I mean, just happy, giddy, and as loud as their music, where the preacher is, while quite likable and good-looking, almost too exciting to take. I wonder if that kind of principle of dynamism filters out people who would otherwise be there to hear the message.
Oh, I think it might. And I don't know how other people react to that kind of glitz. I react negatively. But I think that if a person is a sin-sick sinner looking for forgiveness, who wanders into a church because they just got to have forgiveness and they haven't been for a while and want to come back, and they see that kind of stuff going on, where everybody's kind of a forced happiness, I don't know if that person would come back or if they would even open their ears. And I fear that if they did listen intently, they would hear very little about sin and very little forgiveness, because those are not the kind of messages that a happy, glitzy affair would promote.
Pastor Clement Preuss is author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for May. It's called The Fire and the Staff, Lutheran Theology and Practice. If you caught some of our conversations here on the program with him, we have only touched upon the depth of this book, not only in its analysis of the church today, but also in the answers, the solid biblical answers it provides for the church of today and tomorrow. The book is called The Fire and the Staff. It's $26.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House. You've got an hour to do so today. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or go to our website and look for the book, The Fire and the Staff, right there on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Now, when you write or when you call, after the title of the book, Fire and the Staff, the most important thing to remember is Issues, Etc. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, The Fire on the Staff, by our guest in Sauer, Pastor Clement Preuss. Pastor Preuss, thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Pastor Clement Preuss is pastor of Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota, president of the Lutheran youth organization called Higher Things. When we come back from this break, I want your answers to these questions. Here's the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Baccalaureate disagreements lead to two services at Lindbergh High School. Well, more generally, should Christians participate in baccalaureate services? They are broad services nowadays. They're religious services. I'm not talking about graduation. I'm talking about the baccalaureate service. Did you participate in your high school baccalaureate service? What do you remember from it? I remember mine distinctly, vividly. It was held in a Lutheran church. It was for a Lutheran high school. It was all Lutheran. But I didn't go, well, as many of our listeners know, I didn't go to public school. But public schools have baccalaureate services. My producer tells me, what was it, UCC pastor preaching there? UCC pastor doesn't preach at your church, does he, Jeff? No. You went to the service, didn't you? I thought you would have. Well, what do you remember from your baccalaureate service? Joyce Meyer, by the way, was at one of the two Lindbergh High School baccalaureate services. And if you knew that Joyce Meyer, who will be hearing again from our interview yesterday in the third hour of the program, if you knew that she was going to be the speaker at that religious service, would that make a difference on whether you attended? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Call during this break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.